The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People, sending you love today and all days, but happy Valentine's Day. In this episode, it's me, DR, Maya, and Kyle's talking about the news that you don't know from the past week, the underreported news, but the news about race, justice, and equity that you should know. And then we talk about book censorship in Florida, thousands of kids missing from the post-pandemic school system, whole host of stuff. And we continue our Blackest Book Club discussions with a spotlight on All About Love by Bell Hooks. Go download the full reading list now at blackestbookclub.com and purchase the book with our crooked partner, bookshop.org. Here we go. My advice for this week is let love in. You know, some people are just really, you know, we all, I think, at some point struggle with receiving love. People say good things about us and they love us and we just don't know what to do. Be okay with saying, I love you too. Be okay with saying, thank you, I appreciate that. Like, receive love. Let's go.
Family, welcome to this love episode of Pod Save the People. It's airing on Valentine's Day. We're excited. I'm Diara Ballinger. You can find me at Diara Ballinger on Instagram.
Let me do my love voice. This is Miles E. Johnson. You can find me at Feral Rapture on Instagram and Twitter.
I don't have a love voice. This is Kaya Henderson at Henderson Kaya on Twitter.
This is Dre at DRAY on Twitter.
Well, we're going to start off this episode with the queen in
yes!
red. The amazing Rihanna. It's Rihanna. It's not Rihanna, right? I think her name is Rihanna. Isn't that true, everyone?
This is not the time to make that, y'all. We already,
well, because this morning I was, you know, I start my day. I start my day with CBS this morning with my best friend Gail. And Gail let America know this morning that her name is Rihanna, not Rihanna.
Rihanna.
Because she had corrected Ellen many years ago. Anywho, this performance for me was transcendent because Rihanna is rich. She was like, I'm not gyrating and dancing all
Girl,
around the
place.
Girl, you
better say it.
I'm not going to starve myself for 8 weeks before this thing. I am going to give y'all a shimmy. And y'all are going to like it. So today, in honor of Rihanna, I ain't really doing nothing.
I thought you
at
said
work.
Her name was Rihanna.
Oh. Rihanna. Rihanna.
Thank you, Kaya.
Rihanna.
Keep it consistent.
I'm
not doing nothing at work today. Just how Rihanna took a seat during her performance, she sat herself down. Okay? That's what I'm doing today. Because Black women and brown women shouldn't be out here laboring and doing all the dancing on the poles and stuff for
Super Bowl. Y'all is taking this to a
this
whole
is not what I thought
place.
We were going to talk about this morning.
This is how
right.
I felt
Rihanna
about
said,
it.
Don't
this
work.
Is how I felt about it. It was just like, I
come
ain't doing
on,
all
nap
that.
Ministry. Come on, pause,
and
rest,
she's
be.
She's pregnant, but you know what? I'm not talking about that woman's body today. That's her business. Her and the baby is her business.
I want to talk about it. I want to talk about it. I want to talk about it.
Do it. Go ahead, Kaya.
Because it's all of our business as of last night as she rubbed and scrubbed up there on the stage. First of all, I thought I was up dancing, singing, having a good time. Honey, I thought it was awesome. I thought it was amazing. I thought the song list was perfectly curated. When she descended from the heavens in that hot red, I was like, yes, girl, give it all to the people. And then once you realize that she was pregnant, you're like, okay, you don't have to do too much. Just give us a little bit. And I felt like it was absolutely perfect. I thought her dancers were amazing. I have also loved that she did not have any guest performers. She was like, you're going to get this, me. No enhancements, no embellishments.
But Kaya, were you nervous that Kanye was going to come out? Like, I was not nervous about Kanye.
I was hoping that Jay-Z came out when she sang Run This Town Tonight, because it would have been perfect. But whatever. I was nervous that she was on that flipping podium thing floating in the air. And once I realized she was pregnant, I was like, first of all, I was just personally scared. And I was like, no, you could not have me floating up like that. But when I realized that she was pregnant, I was like, oh, my soul, be careful, girl. But it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect.
I just want to give a shout out to Paris Goebel. I believe that's how you pronounce her name. P-A-R-R-I-S-G-O-E-B-E-L. That is the choreographer. Yes.
Come on, Paris.
Of the Super Bowl, and she's also done most of the things with like Fenty, and then she has like a couple of viral dance videos of Justin Bieber's Yummy. And I think that Paris, I've always been in love with how she does things, does movement. She really hyper focuses on a body movement and just does things on beats and sounds that you don't necessarily, your ear doesn't necessarily go to, and she through movement brings those things out. I was in love with that, and I think that now knowing that Rihanna was pregnant, it was such a task to how do we make this thing feel like it's moving? How do we not put the mother at risk? And how do we also do things where Rihanna can jump in and do and express herself through her body without, you know, doing something that was too crazy? And it was so good. I love how she decided to choreograph that. That might have been one of my favorite choreographed moments in a very, very extremely long time. I always love, the thing about Rihanna is she's such a millennial superstar. She's one of like our last like millennial relics. Like I give Beyonce the Gen X, even though we all love her. I definitely think she's like a superstar that Gen X produced, specifically with how she works.
And what she does,
I think that she's like a, like at best a late millennial Gen X person. I feel like Rihanna, she comes on and she performs like, you know what her performance style reminds me of? That cool woman in the Caribbean restaurant who's going to give you your food and she's going to give it to you and you're going to like it. And I'm not doing all of that. And we don't got that. And you the one I tell, we don't got curry chicken. That's her swag on stage. And I think that that is so, I don't know. There is something really rebellious and cool and effortless around Rihanna that makes it so hot. You forget that she's in front of 1,000 people, a million people are watching her, because she makes you feel like this is normal, this is relaxed. And I think that is the energy that we most covet around Rihanna. Is that like anti-showgirl aesthetic that we just really covet. So yeah, go Rihanna, congratulations. ASAP, one
ASAP. Clearly,
he better hang on to that.
Got angels in the sky and in the ovaries and the uterus. Got angels everywhere. Just what?
You all have said most of what I would say about Rihanna's performance, and it was the setup, the stage, all that stuff was amazing. The thing that I'd add is I didn't know that In Living Color was the birth of the halftime performance at the Super Bowl. That the Super Bowl halftime performance used to be like marching bands and sort of stuff that nobody cared about. One year, In Living Color had halftime programming on a different station. They got all these famous people to host and da-da-da. So everybody stopped at halftime, switched stations, and watched In Living Color's Super Bowl halftime show, and then did not come back and watch the Super Bowl. Like, Super Bowl viewership fell for the second half because people were so enthralled with the other station, da-da-da. And the next year, they brought Michael Jackson to do the halftime performance.
Okay.
And that is the history of the Super performance. And of course, it was a Black superstar that created this entire moment that saved the NFL from a ratings drop. That, like, made this moment. And remember, the artists don't get paid for this experience. They even often have to pay themselves to like get all the bells and whistles, even though the NFL does front money, like to do all the things they often have to pay. But it was Michael Jackson that created the genre of Super Bowl halftime performance that we know, but it was In Living Color.
How about that? That inspired it.
You know, all I heard was Black people started a thing and years later,
listen,
we want to take a knee. It's too much and it's too controversial, but I love that story. We should have like a segment called The Blacker You Know, like The More You Know, The Blacker You Know. Was it like a fist that comes up? That was good content. Are you, Shirley Ralph also performed. I didn't see Shirley Ralph perform live. Okay,
I saw it,
but I didn't understand the context with it. Like, was that a replacement for the what was the context of her performing?
So that was actually the anniversary of the first time that the Black National Anthem was ever sung in public, like in on like TV. So this was like the 23rd anniversary. It was like to the day.
That's what she sang.
She sang the Black National Anthem, but it was like the 23rd anniversary, like to the day that it was ever sung, like on a major stage.
Got it. Yeah, I just wanted to honor that because I did see the clip on Twitter, and she did phenomenal. She looked phenomenal, but I was didn't know the context with it, and it's a little, you know. I always got two brains. I'm also like, do not give a Shirley Ralph. Who, you know, we love her. She's having her moment in the brightest part of the sun right now. She's been in the sun, but the brightest part of the sun right now. And it was like, oh, you know what we're going to give? We're going to give Shirley Ralph in a good old red dress, makeup great, National Black Anthem. I'm like, we still understand where the NFL is when it comes to,
when it comes to
racism and anti-blackness. I'm like, don't think that you're going to blind us with one of our favorite stars.
They also had Babyface singing America the Beautiful, which I think they sing America the Beautiful at multiple Super Bowls in addition to the national anthem, but I was a little underwhelmed. It was because he sang America the Beautiful, what seemed like a little bit of it, and then they cut over to the country dude singing the national anthem. And that the country dude's rendition of national anthem was really beautiful. But I just didn't understand. I felt like they were trying to pack too much, be too many things to too many people, maybe.
Mm-hmm. It was giving here. Are y'all good? Are y'all fine? Yeah, it's a little... I love a song, I love a dance, I love a spectacle, I love all those things, but I think I also have to love those mm-hmm. things critically, because often those things are used for Black people as maybe a replacement for like a replacement for the change, the more systemic, deeper changes we want.
Yeah, it's like let 'em eat cake.
Babyface, go sing something.
Right? Yeah.
That's right. Yes.
The other historical thing with this Super Bowl is that there were two Black quarterbacks. Now, I don't know these young men's names. So
Jalen Hurt and Patrick Mahomes. Come on, girl. Come on.
Thank you, Kaya.
Because
they're both adorable. Adorable. But that's really what kept me watching after Rihanna's performance, because I watched the Super Bowl with the room full of gays. And so nobody knew what the hell was going on. Okay. And that performance ended and we were all like, now what are we supposed to do? How is this stereotype that keeps on coming up?
My first job was a scorekeeper. People don't know this about me. I was a scorekeeper all throughout.
Not people don't know this about me.
All throughout high school, I was a scorekeeper. I know sports, I know football, and I know softball.
I was going to say, I was just with probably eight gay men a couple weeks ago, and all we were talking about was football. So,
none of them were in the room I was in. And listen, I'm a collegiate athlete, but still, I have not
collegiate.
I don't know.
You're so black.
I did know a little bit. Like, I think I was the one explaining the most because people were like, "What's a sack? What's this? Lord, what's that?" I was like, "Why don't we just watch a movie or something?"
I will say. This is not black, but the other part of the story that I thought was cute was
the Kelseys. Okay.
I thought that was
sweet. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Travis, killer Trav. Let me tell y'all something. Travis is invited to the cookout. I'm just saying. Killer Trav likes chocolate. Trav. I'm telling you. Killer Trav got the swag, y'all.
The mother was adorable. Like, she was, I saw her interview, uh-huh. and she had like the split one jersey shoe. And the one shoe. Uh-huh. I was like, come on, mom.
Two
brothers
about?
In the Super Bowl, each on opposing teams, right? So when you're the mama, who do you cheer for? Mother had a jersey that was half Kansas City, half Philly. She had a jean jacket, half adorable. And half.
She wore one shoe.
Was for a different team. She was, you know.
It was very cute. Aww. And she was like a vibe. So she was like doing interviews and stuff. And, you know, when the Super Bowl was over, she like hugged the one son and was like, "You did a great job." The other son, she's like, "Congratulations." You know, it's just like, she was like very much still a mom. Like, no glamour, no glitz. She's like, "My boys are playing, proud of them." It was like very honest. And I was like, come on, whoever decided to make this a whole content stream did a good job.
And then I guess, like, before we, like, close out, I do want to honor that in Rihanna's performance, she was honoring Andre Leon Talley
at the very coat. End
in the red leather. And the red leather come out. And I was thinking about it because I certainly was on Christie's website. I was on Christie's website, the auction house. And I was like, you know what? I need to go get something. And I was looking for that because they had the animal print red Norma Kamali that he owned, and I was like, well, where's the red one from the picture that was his homage to his mentor Diane Vreeland? Like, where's that one, and how much is that one going for? And could I get my hands on it? Did they give it to a museum? All behold, Rihanna. Work her way into that, into snagging that. And it was so beautiful. And I just think that, like, when it comes to Rihanna and Andre Leon Talley, of course, I think that Andre Leon Talley's contextualization in the moment and poetization of what Rihanna, how she looked in that beautiful yellow gown, I think that
I remember that, Miles.
That just as much helped it be iconic. I think that if he wasn't there articulating in the moment how important that was, I don't think that we would have I think we needed help contextualizing what we were seeing, and Andre helped that. And then, of course, all the things that Rihanna's been able to do in fashion and beauty, that moment helped her because it just solidified her. And I just love that she honored his life and his and what he did in her life. It brought me joy. Okay, we are so excited to continue our Black is Book Club programming. We partnered up with Reconstruction and Campaign Zero to launch an amazing book list for our listeners. Curated by me, DeRay, Diara, and Kaya, download the positive People Black is Book Club reading list at blackestbookclub.com right now. So this week's book is all about Love by Bell Hooks. I thought because, it's... you know, Black History Month, and we're doing this program, but then also because it's Valentine's Day, this was such a good intersection of both of those things. Bell Hooks is just a premier writer. Everybody knows that I covet Bell Hooks. I really feel like she expanded my consciousness in so many different ways. Every single book to me, she touched points, different sections. It just like illuminates things in my critical consciousness about the media, film, sex, etc. Love, All About Love is, I think, probably one of her most popular pieces of writing, but also one of her most powerful. And I would dare to say, my most provocative take about this is that it's one of the few books outside of a Cornel West text that has really, to me, prolonged and continued the legacy of Martin Luther King, of really intersecting a love politic, a feminist politic, a racial justice politic, and really takes all of those things seriously. I remember I was reading this book, crying, thinking about, you know, you go through it all. Like, my daddy ain't love me enough, and that's why the boyfriend ain't love me enough, and I thought that was love, but it wasn't love. You go through all of it with bell hooks. But what really stopped me and really transformed my life, I talk about this with DeRay a lot, was chapter 13 on divine love. I thought it was so brave for somebody who has such esteem in intellectual feminist theory to dive into talking about the ethereal, dive in talking about the divine. And that's just something that does not happen, specifically as we get later and later and later in feminist theoretical texts. And I thought that was so brave of her doing. One of my favorite, I screenshotted one of my favorite moments of that chapter. Woundedness is not a cause for shame. It is necessary for spiritual growth and awakening. That was a sentence. I can remember how strange it seemed to me as a child when I read this story over and over in my big book of Bible stories for children, that to be wounded could be a blessing. To my child's mind, woundedness was always negative. Being able to protect oneself from hurts inflicted by others was a source of shame. And coming out of shame, Gershon Kaufman and Lev Raphael contended, shame is the most disturbing emotion we ever experience directly about ourselves. For in the moment of shame, we feel deeply divided from ourselves. Shame is like a wound made by an unseen hand in response to defeat, failure, rejection. At the same moment that we feel disconnected, we long and embrace ourselves to once more feel reunited. Shame divides us from ourselves just as it divides us from others. And because we still yearn for a reunion, shame is deeply disturbing. Shame about woundedness keeps many people from seeking healing. That just shook me, because I never thought about what is happening internally inside of me and how most of the echoes of what's happening internally inside of me are shame, are based in those things, and how she intellectualizes things. Because I love a Brene Brown and a Oprah Winfrey, and I love a woo woo woo. But something about a grounded intellectual bell hook saying, no, there is intellectual genius theoretical backing towards this, and she examines love and shame and these topics scholarly. She cites her sources, she contextualizes it with her own experiences, she's done the research sometimes through her own relationships, and it really contextualizes great. And then in the same chapter, she's talking about angels and God and spiritual practice and how Black women and Black communities need spiritual practice, and anything that we're doing that does not invite spiritual practice is a dead works. It won't make sense for Black people. That is a part and a dimension of what helps us stay radical. We need that. Not we want that, not it's cool. We need that. And it's our job as a generation to maybe recontextualize it and continuously recontextualize spirituality and faith and ancestors for each generation, but we need to always do that work. And I think bell hooks was doing a really brave thing with this. And years later, I remember during the pandemic when I would go for my little walks alone, and everybody had to be, you know, everybody was in the park and everybody had to be 6 feet away from each other. When I tell you, I saw this little red book everywhere in Prospect Park, and I was seeing it everywhere. And I said, wow, I can get choked up thinking about it, because of course, bell hooks passed away. But I remember thinking about it and saying, wow, bell hooks is being read throughout just Brooklyn Park. I can see it in people's tote bags. I can see it on the train station. Her message is really being spread. And, you know, I always wanted to start an Instagram where I take pictures of every single time I see All About Love in the Wilderness or something like that. And just to honor the fact that her message is being spread. And I think in her lifetime, I don't know if she really understood how many people were reading bell hooks, how bell hooks was still doing the work and reaching more people because of social media, reaching more people because of conversation. I don't know if she experienced it, how it really was. And yeah, I can go on all day about how much I love bell hooks and about All About Love and how it's a necessary read, but I won't, because you know, All About Love taught me to share. So I'm gonna share this conversation.
Come on, segue. So I'll just say, as an organizer, Bell Hooks really changed my life. It was the first time I'd heard anybody write about white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. I'll never forget that in college. But imperialist, right? I missed it. I was like, okay, Bell. I remember when I first started, I'm like, okay, Bell, what's going on? Then I'm like, ooh, Dre, you didn't know. So there are two things I want to say about this book. One is that she reminds us that the greatest act we do in the world is with each other, right? Like, community is the best that we will ever do. Being in relationship and partnership with each other is the best that we will ever see. It is what feminism is, blah, blah. So like, that was a big part of it. But as an organizer, so much of the work that I do day to day is rooted in loss. It is death. I was called to the street because somebody was killed, and I continue to be called because of that. And she helped me understand the reconciliation with death as an act of love. And in All About Love, she writes, "Love knows no shame. To be loving is to be open to grief, to be touched by sorrow, even sorrow that is unending. The way we grieve is informed by whether we know love. Since loving lets us let go of so much fear, it also guides our grief. When we lose someone we love, we can grieve without shame. Given that commitment is an important aspect of love, we who love know we must maintain ties in life and death. Our mourning, our letting ourselves grieve over the loss of loved ones, is an expression of our commitment, a form of communication and communion." And when I think about the work that I do that wakes me up every day, my father called me when Tyre Nichols was killed, and he was like, "Dre, how do you do this work?" And I think about the work of organizing as an act of love and a reminder of my commitment to community and my commitment to say and do the work that is called love in practice. And the beauty of the book was that I knew the feelings well, I didn't have the language. And what Bell did was Bell gave me the language for the thing that I was experiencing. And what we say in organizing, right, is that people often have the experience before they have the language. What Bell did was give me the language.
I'll riff off of that, Dre, because my context with Bell Hooks was my African American studies program at McAllister College. McAllister College is a small liberal arts school in St. Paul, Minnesota. Now, when I got to McAllister, they did not have an African American studies department. And so a group of us majored in it. We had to design the major, which ended up being actually having two majors at once. And we also, led some organizing work to get more Black professors tenured at McAllister. But when we started, when the program was kind of getting on its feet, it was fascinating because, you know, the canon was very much W.E.B. Du Bois, Up from Slavery, Manny Marable, Juan Williams. Like, it was very much a Black man's perspective on the political history, social history of Black peoples. And oftentimes I felt like, to DeRay's point, I was having all these feels, right? I was learning these things. I was in classrooms that were predominantly white, and I was having the feels. And I think it was being exposed to writers, thinkers, academics like Bell Hooks, because it was so instructive and it was so heartfelt and soulfelt. And it gave you a construct to be able to understand what was happening to you in that moment. And also how you can protect yourself and essentially have tools to exist through what you were learning, but also what you were trying to be in the world. And so it was, you know, reading Bell Hooks, reading Ashada Shakur, reading Angela Davis, that I really started to find like my grounding in Black studies. And so this book in particular, I found it to be, you know, courageous one, but also, again, so smart, because I think it's also understanding that like love is an ethic. And how are we practicing it, right? As a people, but also, again, a people that has to deal with this exterior world. So, Miles, thank you for this. You know, we love Bell Hooks. And she's so special to so many of us and has come into our lives at very different moments. It's been like decades now. She's been influencing so many of us. So thank you for bringing this. Love, love, love.
I feel like I want to echo DeRay's comment about having the feelings and not having the language. What I think she does in this book, which is super powerful, is help us understand that the construct of love is not just romantic love, right? It is organizing, it is friendships, it is how we think about and react to power and domination and just love in all of its different dimensions. And I think, you know, it is somebody, I read something on social media that said something like, the books that are being banned are the books that you should be reading. And I think it's no small coincidence that in the whole debate about the College Board's first African-American AP history exam, the question of whether bell hooks is part of the canon is one of them. And I think it's because she's so relevant. It's because she's so prescient. It's because she is so intellectual, Miles, that whether she's included in the College Board course or your McAllister, you know, major or whatever, bell hooks is somebody that we all have to encounter as Black people if we want to call ourselves conscious. So thank you for bringing this to the Blackest Book Club ever. This show is the Blackest Book Club, I'm going to tell you. Honey.
Okay, listen, we need to be on tour next year. Libraries and bookstores around the world. That'll be a child, how it's going. That'll be a five location tour. Yep, so go check out our Blackest Book Club reading list at theblackestbookclub.com. At the link, you can download the list and make a purchase in support of the cause. We designed a limited edition Blackest Book Club apparel collection featuring a range of designs and colors just for you. Stay tuned this month as we grab a book from the list each week and spend time digesting together.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
If you're listening to this episode of the podcast and saying, well, geez, I'm hearing a lot of Miles' voice, I thought the same thing too. You know, you never know when you're producing something, how it's going to sound, and I'm getting tired of the sound of my own voice. However, I have things to talk about. So we talk about bell hooks, and now we got to go into my other love. It's you know, it goes from Black radical queer feminism to fashion. Those are my two heartstrings. I didn't get to talk about it a couple of weeks ago, but we did experience a death in the fashion community by Paco Rabanne. So when it comes to surrealism and when it comes to fashion, the surrealist fashion designers are so integral to expanding what other people who maybe even consider themselves not into fashion are wearing, and also recontextualizing beauty. So what do I mean by that? I mean, when somebody puts on a really avant-garde, strange garment, or somebody chooses a very different model, Yves Saint Laurent with Black models, Paco Rabanne with Black models as well, so that was seen as like left of center in a specific era. When somebody decides to do that, then that trickles down to what people in their everyday lives see as beautiful. That trickles down to what other people take risks. So even if you are traditionally beautiful, am I going to succumb to what society says I need to do? Or am I going to take my own risk? And I truly believe that there is these avant-garde, surrealist fashion designers that give us more room to breathe in beauty and in fashion and in glamour. So it can be something that we can all participate in healthily and not, you know. I was going to say Kardashian-ly, but keeping it very healthy and keeping us expanded. Paco Rabanne is one of the pioneering fashion designers when it comes to that. He was actually best friends and really good friends and competitors with Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali was noted of saying that there's only two great surrealists in Spain, me and Paco Rabanne, which is like a huge, huge, huge honor. When you look up Paco Rabanne's fashion designs and choices and runway shows, you'll see that he has dressed some beautiful, beautiful Black models and has really put Black woman in the context of space age. It's literally, if we, when you see the images and this is not to disrespect the literary icon I'm about to say, but when you see the images, it's really like the fact, like when you see a Black woman dressed in space age haute couture, it really makes you think, oh, this is what Octavia, but this is what the characters in some of Octavia Butler's or Samuel Delany's text wear. I really remember that my first interaction with those texts and with that literature, I was literally picturing Paco Rabanne outfits and some of the things that they were writing about, because that was my only context for Black people in fashionable things that were also futuristic, was because of him. I'm trying to think of a current pop culture moment. Oh, Cardi B at the Grammys, that good metallic chrome outfit that she wore with the headpiece, that was Paco Rabanne. Naomi Campbell, you could put Naomi Campbell and Paco Rabanne, Iman Paco Rabanne, you could put all these Google images, and you'll kind of see the aesthetic that he has garnered. If you go to your local church, the good one, the mega church, and you take a whiff in the air where the men are, what is that scent? That is 1 million by Paco Rabanne. and if you sniff a little harder underneath that note of 1 million, there's another scent, and that's usually a Victigas or Victory. So if you have not seen it, you definitely done smelt it. And if you haven't done either, then I implore you to go explore it. Yeah, I wanted to bring this to the podcast. I was really sad that I didn't get to do it the other week, and I love just getting people to think differently about things that are sometimes coded as frivolous or feminine or queer and pop culture, because usually those things are seen as unserious and not influential. But we often know that sometimes those things could be the most influential things. And I think it's good to honor people who really did it right. He died at 88. Life well lived.
I am married to somebody who is Mexican and Cuban, but grew up in Spain. And so Paula and I spend a lot of time in Spain, in Madrid in particular. So, you know, I'm like, I'm spending so much time in this place. Let me learn something other than the past colonialism. We all know that about Spain. But also understanding that, you know, Spain had a dictator for a long time. But what came out of the end of Franco was all of this creative, revolutionary, beautiful content, art, all of it. So, you know, Pedro Almodóvar is like this brilliant filmmaker who was, you know, centering the lives of trans women and, you know, LGBTQ people, but in the early 70s. And so I think when I think about Paco Rabanne and when I think about, you know, kind of the artists of that time, it's just exciting. It's exciting what they create, I think, is so, Miles, to your point, futuristic. And it's just, I've just been such a fan of it. And what I didn't know about Paco Rabanne is that, okay, so his father was a Republican colonel who was executed by Franco troops during the Spanish Civil War. His mother was the chief seamstress for Balenciaga, for Balenciaga's first couture house. And so she ended up moving her family to Paris, which, you know, the rest is sort of history for Paco Rabanne. So it's just, you know, again, all of that Franco history, I think, is tied into so many of the great artists and creators out of Spain.
I, like many people who grew up in the 80s, smelled Paco Rabanne before I saw him. You know, if your dude didn't have some Paco Rabanne cologne, then you might want to rethink that thing. And so it was refreshing to learn that he was the first designer to stage Black runway models, and to look at his futuristic designs. It's really just inspiring. And then you look at what everybody else is doing these days and you realize it ain't nothing new under the sun. So thanks for bringing this to the pod, Miles. This was really, really, this was a learning experience.
I'll just say two things. I love that Paco Rabanne started off as an architect. I just love people who like sort of art in many places. And I'm always fascinated by people who have pseudonyms. I love that his birth name was not Paco Rabanne, that he like chose Paco Rabanne as a name. And I just like the it just so fits the idea that you like make your thing. Like he just made up, you know, he said he lived many lives. He knew Jesus. I love it. I'm all about it. I'm like, that is reflected in the clothes. And like, I love, love, love the pseudonyms. Just like Toni Morrison. I love it. I like that level of creativity and like to go out in the world in that way is cool.
Well, my news this week is about a significant problem in education that not a lot of people are talking about. When we think about what happened to kids during the pandemic, we are seeing a lot of conversation about test scores going down and how learning didn't happen and learning loss. But what we aren't talking about is how thousands of kids are missing from school. There was a recent analysis done by the Associated Press, Stanford University's Big Local News Project, and Stanford professor Thomas D. And they found that an estimated 230,000 students in 21 states are missing from public school rolls. Now, these are not kids. They didn't move out of state. They didn't enroll in a private school. They didn't switch to homeschooling. These are kids who are literally just disappeared. And sometimes it's because, you know, families are still afraid of COVID, or some families are experiencing homelessness, or they've left the country. In many cases, though, online learning just wasn't good for kids, or some young people have found jobs. Some young people are just depressed. Many young people were having terrible experiences in the schoolhouse even before the pandemic. The pandemic just exacerbated that. And they were like, you know what? I'm out. I'm not going back. And this article actually shares a few stories of young people who basically have just opted out of school. 230,000 kids is a big number, but it is probably nowhere near the number of kids that are actually missing. Overall, public school enrollment fell by 710,000 students between 2019 and 2022, the main years of the pandemic. Private school enrollment grew, but only by 100,000. Homeschooling grew by 180,000. That is a huge statement where parents are like, I can do this myself. I don't have to send kids to school. But 230,000 is nowhere near the delta between that 710 and those 280,000 kids who went to private school or homeschool. And the analysis doesn't include data from 29 states, including big states like Texas and Illinois. It doesn't include ghost students, which are students who are still on the rolls, but they're absent from class. This is a huge problem. In California alone, 152,000 students missing. In New York, 60,000 students missing. In Louisiana, 19,000. North Carolina, 12,000. And so the total is likely way more than 230,000. And these are kids who are out in the world, families that are in the world who are going to show up in other systems because they are not getting the support and the services that they need. As you can imagine, this problem is even more acute for students with disabilities. And we have not been talking about this, but we're going to start talking about this next year when all of this ESSER money, the funds that the federal government has poured into school districts to support the transition back from the pandemic, those funds are going to run out next year. And school districts are going to have to contend with the fact that their budgets reflect far fewer kids. And for people who don't know, our schools are funded on a per pupil student formula where you basically get money for the students that you have enrolled. And so when you lose 150,000 students, that means that there's going to be huge budgetary cuts in California, huge budgetary cuts in New York and Louisiana and North Carolina. And that's when we're going to start talking about these missing kids. Many school districts right after the pandemic went out looking for kids, knocking on doors. Many created support systems, providing laundry services and stuff for families who were experiencing challenges. But all of that has sort of dried up and withered away. And shout out to Stanford and the Associated Press and Professor D for bringing this data to light, because these are kids and families who we are responsible for, and who, you know, we're going to have to reckon with one way or the other.
You know, as somebody who worked in a school system and had to help, you know, get kids to come back to school and that whole process, this blew my mind. Like, I just didn't realize there was this many kids unaccounted for. I knew that there's going to be a dip. I didn't know that there were this many kids that we literally just didn't know. We didn't know where they were. And as somebody who worked in school systems, two big school systems, this actually really surprised me. So I'm interested to see what will pop up. Because I remember in Baltimore, you know, and I don't know if it was like this with you, Kai, but we were like making it up. Like, the strategy to get kids come back was not, you know, wasn't brilliant. It was literally like going to people's doors, knocking on, like, it wasn't like some, it was very old school organizing, you know, the teachers union even did it with us because we all had a vested interest in kids coming back. So this was fascinating. I didn't know the numbers were this high. It really blew my mind.
Yeah. I think the undercurrent at this teaching for me, I was really excited to hear what you and DeRay had to say about this because of y'all's background. But also, the first thing that came to my mind was, what happens when these kids are missing, and it makes it. My mind couldn't help but go to literacy and crime and jail and all these other things that happen when kids don't go to school and when kids aren't learning. And I think that I forgot the exact words that she used at the end of what you said, Kaya, but that they will have to be accounted for, and that it'll have to be reckoned with. That's what keeps on echoing in my head, is that this is going to have to be reckoned with. And when we see escalations in illiteracy or crime or whatever, we have to go back to this. We have to go back to what's happening right now. And that's what's most scary to me.
Yeah, I thought, you know, we're outside and we're acting like, you know, the pandemic is over. The federal government has now declared that the pandemic is over and everybody is quote unquote back to normal. And there are so many repercussions from this pandemic that we have yet to confront. And this is just one of them.
I guess the other thing I'm trying to figure out is how do we support this, right? Like, I got a little time on my hands sometimes. I live in New York City. Like, are there opportunities for people to volunteer? And I don't even know what that looks like in schools. But I feel like, I don't know, for many of us, you know, we're living in communities that we did not grow up in. It is, you know, I guess that maybe is like, maybe one of the things I want to accomplish in 2023 is figuring out how to get more connected with this community. Not the community that is now predominant here. I live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. You know, even our people in office aren't people that grew up here, right? So it's like how to get plugged in to the community that is actually this community, right? Because we all have public schools in our neighborhoods, right? Like, how do we get plugged in? How can we be supportive? And if it's not appropriate to be engaging, you know, with folks directly, how can we support financially? So I don't know. I guess I'm my head goes to how do we start to problem solve for folks who are outside of the system. And what does that look like?
Yeah, Diarra, I think, I mean, because of lots of student privacy laws, the release of information to volunteers is restricted. But I do think that what this, the question that this causes us to ask is, what happens when our one-size-fits-all school model doesn't fit all? What mm-hmm. happens when young people who are struggling with deep mental illness, we don't have supports for them in the right way. And I feel like the pandemic just began to open up that conversation, even though we should have been having that conversation for a long time. I think the other question that it forces us to ask is kids don't just learn in school. And so how do we create opportunities for kids to learn in places and spaces where they feel the most comfortable? And how do we get that to count in school? Because if a kid doesn't feel, and families, I mean, these families in this article are like, I don't trust the school system. This one parent mm-hmm. is willing to give up her kid's special education status, services that are required to support this young man, just so that he can be transferred to another school because she doesn't trust the school system that she's in. We have to confront the fact that these spaces are not made for many of our young people and start to design and build something different.
So my news is about good old Mississippi, about Jackson, Mississippi, or about the State House. And, you know, I feel like I say all the time, I'm rarely shocked at it. And then something new happens. So I'm like, well, white supremacists got me again. And in what the, so Jackson is the capital city of Mississippi. So the State House is in Jackson. And you already heard the previous stories where they didn't invest in the water. There were problems with having clean water in Jackson. But now House Bill 1020 would essentially create a separate court system and an expanded police force in Jackson, which is the blackest city in America, that would be controlled by all white people. Jackson is 80% black. And as I said, it's the capital city of Mississippi, and it's home to a higher percentage of black residents than any major American city. So this bill would allow the white chief justice of the Mississippi Supreme Court to appoint two judges to oversee a completely new district that covers the city, one that includes all of the city's majority white neighborhoods and some other areas. The white state attorney general would appoint four prosecutors, a court clerk, and four public defenders for this new district. And the white public safety commissioner would oversee an expansion of the Capitol Police Force, which is currently run by a white chief. There have already been criticisms of the Capitol Police Force because they have killed people in Jackson with very little repercussions. And here's the thing. There's already a functioning court system. There's already, Lord knows, there's enough police for a lifetime. There's because there's a local police and there are police who are the Capitol Police that ostensibly report to the legislature. And it's just wild to see this in 2023 when people say everything goes back to race. It does. And remember, you know, in this moment, the Mississippi Constitution gives the legislature the authority to make, quote, inferior courts. Courts that are lower than the Supreme Court of Mississippi, and this is how they would be doing it. Mind you, the representative who is proposing this lives 120 miles away from Jackson, is not a Jackson resident, nothing to do with Jackson, but they do want to control where the black people live. And I brought this because it literally blew my mind when I read it.
I read this too, DeRay, and it was so outrageous that I just had to put it down. But here we are talking about it on the pod. I have been to Jackson, Mississippi on numerous occasions. I feel honored to do work with the Jackson Public School System. And the crime rate in Jackson is incredibly high. And like a lot of urban places, especially post-pandemic. But like, there's no other way to think about this. Like, there's no generous explanation. There is no positive spin. There is no nothing. Like, there's no way to see this as helpful. The only way to see this is as colonial and whatnot. And I thought, you've heard the adage, be careful of, if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. But I thought there was an interesting piece in here about how in 1890, there was a Jim Crow era constitution that was written in Mississippi to strip voting rights from Black Mississippians. And one of the representatives said, this is just like the 1890 constitution all over again. We're doing exactly what they said we were doing back then, helping those people because they can't govern themselves. This patriarchal, colonizing approach to managing people in Jackson, Mississippi, the blackest place in the blackest city in the country, is reprehensible. And And it ain't the first time and it won't be the last time. But this is what these super majority of Republicans can do in states where they don't need not a one Democratic vote to pass legislation. And so I don't think we've paid appropriate attention to how in these state houses, there are far too many cases where, you know, a counter vote doesn't even matter because the Republicans have a supermajority. And this is what it looks like in Mississippi.
I was going to say old school racism. I really had nothing really profound to add to what was going on, but that it's old school racism, old school, just like kind of like white supremacist tyranny. And it's wild that it's just like, I think that the bigger thing that is in my head is just around Mississippi. Since I've been on this podcast, we've mentioned Mississippi so many times, and I'm like, we need all eyes on Mississippi. We're like white supremacy as far as its erasure, as far as us really improving, it's measured by how well Mississippi's doing. That's where it's measured at. It's not measured by what's happening in coastal neoliberal bubbles. It's not being measured in any other places. If the blackest place is not free, then ain't nothing free. If the blackest place is being controlled, then we're still controlled. So Mississippi, if it ain't goddamn Mississippi, like Nina Simone said, then you know. Nowhere is blessed for black people in America, and I really believe that, and I believe that since I started this podcast and seeing and reading how much of these how much white supremacist domination is just running wild in the laws and legislation happening in Mississippi.
And when you look at how Mississippi ranks nationally,
girl, say
on anything, on anything. Healthcare at the bottom, gambling addictions at the top. People can't find a job. The economic environment is terrible. The lowest average starting salary, terrible quality of public schools, terrible quality of early education.
Former
system.
Football players stealing welfare money.
Listen, you know, nobody wants to retire there. They're 70% of young adults. In Mississippi, 70% of young adults are ineligible to join the U.S. military because they fail academic, moral, or health qualifications. They have the highest number of at-risk youth. Like it is when you go bar to bar in terms of what makes a state functioning, innovative, democratic, equitable, Mississippi is at the bottom. So what is the plan here? White legislature, are you just gonna squeeze all the resources to the top? Because in all actuality, there are a lot of poor white folks who are suffering from all of these things too. So is it just the deep commitment to white supremacy at all costs? Is that what's happening here? Because You're the people at the top, white folks at the top, your pockets aren't going to get any fatter because nobody wants to come there and do anything. So I guess it's just that's how absurd racism and white supremacy is that you go to these links, it just don't make any sense. Just doesn't make sense. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, white supremacy isn't necessarily genius or intelligent or even made to design to keep a human being functioning. You know, white supremacy cannibalizes white folks all the time. White supremacy is the institution that is to survive on itself. It's to make sure white supremacy survives. So it doesn't matter who needs to die, what needs to happen, as long as the idea that whiteness is the best happens. And I feel like Mississippi is just ground zero for those things happening. There's nothing that we, and also there's just nothing that we can advocate about Mississippi that won't be better for everybody else in America. There's nothing that we can get Mississippi to do or to push Mississippi to do that won't help every single person. So the idea that like when you say like if you're helping a, a poor black trans disabled person, if you're helping that person, then everybody else benefits. Same thing when you were talking about the poor white folks in Mississippi and all that other stuff. I'm like, yeah, everything will be better when you talk about deplatforming, destabilizing white supremacy. Everything is better. Like, everything is better. Water gets cleaner. Air, like you know, everything. Places get safer. Everything gets better.
Well, speaking of racist, nonsensical people in power, I'm going to move this conversation to DeSantis. And now what is happening with the application of, you know, these laws and policies he has on the books now about challenging critical race theory. So I saw this and I just... Wow. Because now we're going to see, I think, to Kaya's earlier point around COVID and seeing the implications and the impact. Like, now we're going to start to see how, like, all of this really comes to play with all of this anti-critical race theory stuff. So Roberto Clemente. Now, for those of you Afro-Latinos listening, you know, Roberto Clemente is like, Martin Luther King. Okay. This is serious. He is Afro-Puerto Rican. He black. Okay. He's a black man. So basically he has this book, The Pride of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and it's by Jonah Winter and Raul Colon. And it's just about Roberto Clemente and his rise in baseball, right? He was super, super accomplished in baseball, but he also was just like this magnificent person who led all these humanitarian efforts, who was very vocal in the civil rights movement. So in Jacksonville, Florida, this is Duval County, which I did look up. It is 31% Black. Evidently, Roberto Clemente's book is too controversial, or it raises issues of race and discrimination that is too early for those students. I think it's like K through the third grade, if I remember it from the article correctly. Books must align with state standards, such as not teach K through three students about gender identity, sexual orientation, not teach critical race theory, which examines systemic racism in American society and public grade schools, and not include references to pornography and discrimination, according to the school district, because evidently talking about race is like talking about pornography. I don't know what's wrong with these people. So that means, like, in this process, there are these certified media specialists who are reviewing about 1.5 million book titles. And they've approved about 2,800 books, but they also are not approving books. And one of those books is Roberto Clemente's book. Another one of those books is about Sotomayor, who's the first Puerto Rican woman appointed to the Supreme Court. And the Latino Justice, this organization that it's the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund. They've been blasting the school district in Duval, talking about, you know, how this book is so important to folks' identity, right? And not just to young Afro-Latino students and Black students, but like to all students and how important this history is. Learning about his achievements, his pride, and his Afro-Puerto identity and his struggles with racism and discrimination will provide needed insight on historical conditions in the U.S. and inspiration for the majority of Black and Latino student population in Duval County schools. So the other interesting thing is here is when his son was interviewed, Robert Clemente Jr., he said about his dad's story. His story is his story. He went through racism. It's something that can be changed. But obviously for the younger students, if it's something that they feel is too much for them, they might be able to utilize a different book with the same story, but it's framed differently for them, for that age group, that is. I thought that was fascinating. And I'm not gonna like hark on like whether he's right or wrong. But it is just an interesting discussion for me. And the light bulbs kind of went off in my head, because who's been leading the movement, obviously, on pushing back around these policies are Black people. But I think what we're going to start to see is some of the intersectional issues that come, because this is going to impact not just Black people, Black American identifying people, but also Afro-Latino people, Afro-American Latino. Like, it is going to be so expansive that people that we didn't necessarily would think of being impacted, like Justice Sotomayor, will be, right? So it's just, I don't know. I just wanted to bring this to the pod because I found it to be so, one, terrifying, honestly, just terrifying. Like, I just, it's terrifying. But then also how students will actually be impacted and their identity shaped. And then people that we hadn't expected would be looped into this, whose books won't be able to be used in these schools.
Y'all about to get a dose of revolutionary Kaya, because this is some BS. This is complete and total trash. And like, again, this is not the first time that people have denied us our history, us telling our stories. These are stories of empowerment. They don't want you to read about Afro-Latinos who broke through the color barrier and, you know, changed baseball while at the same time being social and politically active, right? They don't want you to read about the first Latin American, you know, Supreme Court justice or Celia Cruz, the queen of salsa. And like, for as long as they have been trying to deny us the opportunity to read and know who we are, we have been resisting. We have had freedom schools and citizenship schools. Our people during enslavement times actually taught each other how to read under the penalty of death because it was so important. And these are the same people that tell us that we don't value education, that we don't, you know, like, this is bananas, right? And Ron DeSantis is doing a masterful job. And I don't know. I feel like I want to go to Florida and tell me where to sign up for the revolution, because this is trash. This is why we started Reconstruction, because we cannot rely on schools to teach our children our history and our culture. We cannot rely on them to show Black excellence, to show Black intellectualism. We cannot. We have to. And other ethnicities don't either, right? The Jews are not waiting for school to tell their kids, you know, their history or their culture or how amazing they are. Korean people send their kids to Korean school. Greek people send their kids to Greek school. And we have to send our kids to schools that are populated by people who love them, who believe in them, and who are going to make sure that they know what they need to be whole, complete people, to be out here in these streets fighting every day. You listen, child, don't get me started.
Okay, I just got, okay, let me throw this coffee out, because Kaya is here. She's here saying some stuff, and it's just, her screen is brightening it up. She's just here. The one thing I do want to say, because I like was listening to so many people discuss, it just has been obviously just been a topic on like political pundit shows and stuff like that. And I'm not saying that this has not happened, I'm just saying that I did not hear this perspective happen, is sometimes when we talk about the books that are going to be in the school or be taken out of the school, it's always how good it is for, you know, the Afro-Latina or Afro-Latinx child to read about Afro-Latinx heroes, and the Black child to read about Black American child to read about Black American heroes. And I'm like, and obviously, yes, that is very true. But also, and this is what I was talking about a little bit earlier about how white supremacy cannibalizes itself. It is fantastic for white kids to read about other heroes
that do not look like them.
It is not good to be in a narcissistic intellectual bubble where you are centered and where everything that is what creates a culture of acceptable sociopathic nature.
You better say it.
In my opinion.
Yep.
You better say it. Acceptable, you know, sociopathic nature. He's talking about, well, I'm going to let you say what you're saying.
Yeah, and I feel like that is not that's not necessarily a perspective that I always see people talk about, and how it's healthy for all kids to learn about all diverse, different people who are doing different things. There are so many. That's why even on this podcast, at the big age of 32, I still push myself to bring Paco Rabanne and other people who are outside of my race and my experience to the podcast, and to contextualize it through a Black queer lens, but also know that there's other people doing things with other perspectives that helps me feel bigger. And then it's in their uniqueness, a perspective and a journey that I actually find, it's in that subjective hero's journey that I find the universal truth. It's in that subjective experience of how they got over that I find a universal truth about the human spirit, mm-hmm. tenacity, vision, and the human condition. And that is healthy. And that is what makes kids not go yes. pick up guns. That's what makes kids not go to school and say horrible things, because they are conditioning themselves to see other people as human and as actual people. And when you stop doing that, you are asking for violent violent events. You're asking, be it literal violence or be it just the casual, intimate, parasocial violence that happens when kids are drenched in white supremacy. That's what I gotta say about this. It's just a little ridiculous. It's good for all. It's good for all. It's not just good for the Black kids or the Afro-Latinx kids or the Jewish children or the. It's good for everybody to know about everybody's history, mm-hmm. so we can actually use race and culture for what it's meant for, which is the beauty of diversity in the human race. So it's to recognize the beauty and diversity in the human race, rather.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning into Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out. Make sure to rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Lands. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, Diarra Ballinger, and Miles Johnson. Hey, hey.